couple of questions here. Oh, I looked up upadana. It doesn't seem to be derived from dana. It's that which enables a process to keep going. That's literally what it means. So, is the sukha one experiences in jhana different in degree or kind from the sukha one might enjoy in everyday life? I would say not really. It's the origin of it that differs. In everyday life, when we experience sukha, it's because of some external circumstances, right? Whereas the sukha that we're experiencing in the jhanas is brought on simply by concentrating your mind. So it's the origin of it that's different. But I would think that the experience is the same. At least that's my own personal experience. And since all of this stuff is just neurotransmitters, I wouldn't think that there would be a special set of neurotransmitters just for if you're practicing jhanas. I think it's tapping into stuff that's there all along. Once upon a time, a long time ago, in the great city of Calcutta, there lived a young man by the name of Mohan. Mohan had been born into a family of street magicians. They made their living doing card tricks and sleight of hand and so forth. Mohan learned how to do all this, learned the skills, and was quite good at it. But he really wanted to learn the real magic. And so he began inquiring around as to where he could find the world's greatest magician. And the word seemed to be that the world's greatest magician lived in Rajasthan, on the total other side of India. But Mohan was determined, and eventually he managed to save up enough money, and he set off on a journey to go all the way across India to the state of Rajasthan. Now, the story of his travels could entertain us until it was time to go to sleep, but let's just cut to the chase. And he eventually arrived at the village in Rajasthan where supposedly the world's greatest magician lived. He went to the market and he inquired and was told, "Oh, yeah, big house on the edge of town. You can't miss it. 2 stories tall. There's a corral full of horses out front." And so Mohan moseys on through the village, and sure enough, can't miss it, big house, 2 stories, corral full of horses out front. At that point, he almost loses his nerve. This is a very impressive place, and what's he, this poor street magician, doing disturbing this grand person? But he'd come all this way, and so finally he screwed up his courage, walked up to the door, knocked on it. It was opened by someone who appeared to be a servant and said, "Yes." And he said, "I've come to see the world's greatest magician." "Oh, please wait here." The servant disappeared into the house. And about a minute later, this rather elderly Indian man, short even for an Indian, appears. And he's got this amazing twinkle in his eye. And he says, "Yes, may I help you?" "I've come to see the world's greatest magician." "Oh, you have you? Ha, 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 come in, come in." Leads Mohan upstairs to a sitting room. And then he starts asking Mohan the usual questions. "Where do you come from? Are your parents still alive? How many brothers and sisters do you have?" If you've been to Asia, you know the drill. And Mohan's busy answering the questions and so forth. And finally, the magician says to Mohan, "Well, why have you come all this way?" "I want to learn the real magic." "The real magic? The real magic?" Just at that point, the magician's wife comes into the room. She's carrying a silver tray, and on the tray are 2 teacups and a pot of tea. She hands one of the teacups to Mohan, picks up the pot of tea, and just starts to pour it. And as soon as the first drop of tea hits the bottom of Mohan's cup, there's a giant earthquake. I mean, serious earthquake, like 8 on the Richter scale, and the whole house is shaking. The magician's wife drops the tray, runs out of the room. The magician runs out of the room. Mohan drops his teacup, runs out of the room. Everybody in the house is running outside. Mohan staggers down these moving stairs and finally outside with everybody else. Everybody in the house has run to the corral. Somebody's thrown open the gate, and everybody's leaping on the back of a horse and riding off. Mohan runs to the corral. There's only one horse left, this big stallion. He grabs it around the neck, hurls himself onto its back, and the stallion bolts in terror of this ongoing earthquake. Mohan's not so much riding as hanging on for dear life. The stallion gallops as fast as he can for maybe 5 minutes, and then he begins to slow down. And finally, Mohan can sit up and, you know, pet the horse. "Okay, horsey, it's okay. The earthquake's over. We need to go home." And he pushes the horse's head and gets him turned around. And they can follow the tracks in the sand. You see, Rajasthan is a desert state. And so they start following the tracks back. About 2 minutes later, there's a sudden gust of wind that in another few seconds turns into a full-blown sandstorm. Luckily, there's a rocky outcropping, and Mohan can get himself and the horse in the lee of this rocky outcropping, and all they can do is wait for the sandstorm to blow itself out. It's really quite the sandstorm, and it lasts for about an hour and a half. And then as suddenly as it arose, the wind drops. It's totally quiet again. Well, not able to follow the tracks back to the house. Duh. But the horse knows the way home, so Mohan swings up onto its back and says, "Let's go home. Go home, horse." Heads in the same direction that he'd been following the tracks. 5 minutes go by. 10 minutes. 20 minutes. Mohan can't see anything. There's no sign of the village. There's nothing. The sun is going down. What's going on? It gets dark. There's no lights, no fires, nothing. It's just Mohan and the horse on the desert. There, it's a full moon, so at least he has light to see by. Nothing to do but, you know, hope the horse can find its way home. They keep riding. At one point around midnight, Mohan fell asleep and fell off the horse. Landed in a bush, got a little scratched up, but wasn't hurt. The horse didn't run away, thankfully. Managed to mount back up and keep riding. No sign of a light anywhere. It's just sand and a few scrubby bushes. That's it. Eventually, it starts to get light. This is going to be rather dangerous. Mohan has been out here all night. He hasn't had any water. He didn't even get to drink his cup of tea. He's got no food and a horse that doesn't know the way home. He's going to have to find some shelter because this is the desert and the sun's coming up and it's going to get really stinking hot. And all of a sudden, the horse pricks up its ears, breaks into a little trot, and they come to a stream, not more than about a yard wide, full of rushing water. The horse, face down in the stream. Mohan, face down in the stream, upstream from the horse. They drink their fill of water. There's some grass growing there so the horse can eat some grass, but Mohan doesn't eat grass. He's now really hungry. And he's still got to find some place to spend the day. But he knows if he goes downstream, eventually he'll find a village, a town, somebody that can direct him back to the magician's village. So he starts following the stream, and isn't long before, another rocky outcropping. And he can get in the shade of this outcropping, and it's definitely cooler in the shade than there in the sunshine, and he falls asleep. He wakes up. He slept most of the day. The sun is going down. The horse is still there. This is good. So he mounts up. Kind of dark after the sun goes down for the first hour until the moon comes up. And then, yeah, pretty easy to follow the stream. And he's looking, no sign of lights anywhere. Just keeps riding and riding all night long. He doesn't fall asleep this time. And then it begins to get light again. All right, he's got to find some shelter. Now, by now, this little stream has gotten really big. It's a raging river. He's looking around trying to see some shelter. Is that smoke? Seems like there's smoke further downstream. He keeps riding, and sure enough, yeah, this is smoke. All right, civilization. He's saved. And he eventually rides up to a bridge across the river, kind of rickety old bridge. And there's obviously a homestead on the other side, and there's smoke coming out of the chimney. He rides across the bridge, clip-clop, 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 comes down on the other side, and the door of the house opens, and three people come out, and they're staring at him in amazement. There's an older man, an older woman, and a very nice-looking young woman about Mohan's age. And they're just staring at him. And he jumps off the horse and says, "There was a big earthquake. Did you feel the earthquake? Well, I jumped on this horse and it bolted and ran away from the magician's house, and I need to get back to the magician's house." And he names the village and everything, and they're just staring at him. And the words had come tumbling out so fast, he realized he probably wasn't making a whole lot of sense. So he starts again explaining what happened. And they're just staring at him. And after he explains again about the magician and the earthquake and the horse and getting lost in the desert, the old man says, "We thought we were the only ones." What? They don't respond. They're just staring at him. The only ones? No, you're not the only ones. You should see Calcutta, where I come from. You're definitely not the only ones. And the magician's village is not far from here. And he names the village again. And when he finishes, the old man says, "We thought we were the only ones." Okay. No, you're not the only ones. There's lots of people around. And I need to return this horse to the magician. And I need to find my way back there, and it would be really nice if I could get something to eat, because I haven't eaten in a couple of days. Would you happen to have something to eat?" And the old woman says to him, "We thought we were the only ones." "No, you're not the only ones." And the old woman says, "Would you like something to eat?" "Yes, that would be very nice." And the older man says, "You can put your horse in the corral." And so Mohan puts the horse in the corral and follows them into the house. The people were just sitting down to breakfast. And they had some chapatis and some dal and some rice. And they gave him what was really, really delicious food because he was starving. And as he sat there, the people begin to open up a little bit about what had happened. The story finally comes out. There used to be a village further downstream, and the old man and the old woman were children in that village. This village was the only place to ford the river, and the caravans used it as a crossing point. And this village made its living by growing food that they could trade to the caravans for the goods that the caravans had. And it was actually a pretty good deal, because there were lots of caravans that came through with all sorts of interesting things to trade. One year, when the old man and the old woman were about 12 years old, the caravans didn't show up. It was caravan season, and there were no caravans coming. A month goes by, no caravans. 2 months go by, no caravans. What's going on? Finally, there's a horseman coming, and everybody in the village runs out and is saying, "Are you from the caravans? Are you from the caravans?" And the horseman goes, No. Caravans won't be coming this way anymore. About 50 miles downstream, the village there built a bridge over the river, and it makes the caravan route a lot shorter if they cross the river there, so they won't be coming this way. The people in the town were, well, devastated, because this is how they had had a good life, and now they weren't going to be getting anything new. It was just whatever they had, whatever food they could grow, and they had this surplus, and they fed the horseman and he rode away on his own. And they were like, what are we going to do? Everybody was very depressed. But not nearly as depressed as they got a few days later when the disease hit. Somebody would wake up in the morning, their head would be kind of stuffy. By lunchtime, they were feeling terrible. And by sundown, they were dead. And this disease just swept through the village, killing almost everybody. There were only two survivors. This boy and girl, about 12 years old. They didn't want to stay in the village. Somehow they had some immunity, but yeah, to stay in this village with all the dead people. So they collected what they could and they moved upstream to this homestead and had been living there ever since. The young woman was their daughter. And they thought they were the only ones. These kids didn't really understand what had happened. And they assumed that, you know, the disease had wiped out everybody on the planet except them. And so when Mohan showed up, it was the first person they'd seen in decades. And they thought they were the only ones. And Mohan, no, he described Calcutta and all the people there. And he described the magician's village and the people there. And he said, you know, I really need to return the magician's horse to him. So I'm going to ride on down the river till I get to that village where the bridge is. And then maybe they'll know how to get back to the magician's village. And the old man says, well, yeah, that makes sense, but you're probably tired. Why don't you rest up for a day? And Mohan thought that was, yeah, that was a good idea. The old woman was a very good cook, and their daughter was very nice. And so he decided to rest. And then the next day, the old man says to him, you know, before you go, it would be really, really helpful for us if we could borrow your horse. You see, to plow the fields so that we can plant our crops and grow the food that we live on, I've been taking the plow and pulling it while my wife guides it. But I'm getting old and it's really hard to do that now. And with your horse, we could plow the field really quickly, like get it all done, even a bigger field, in a couple of days. Mohan was, that makes sense. You know, these people had been really nice to him, and their daughter was really nice. So he decided he would help them out. Well, to make a long story short, 10 years later, there's Mohan and his wife and her parents and their little son, who's about 6. And it's a pretty idyllic life. I mean, yeah, there's not a lot going on. But the old man and the old woman were both great storytellers. They had learned all these stories from the caravans that were coming through, so there was wonderful entertainment in the evening. And their daughter, yeah, turned out she was really, really nice. And it was a great life. Until that fateful day when the old man was walking across the rickety bridge over the river, tripped and fell in the river and drowned. Well, the old woman lost her mind. She's screaming and crying, and she wants to go throw herself in the river, and Mohan's got to hold her back, and his wife is all upset, and his son is all upset, and he's trying to get everybody calmed down, and he's really upset, and yeah, it's really, really horrible. And finally, they get the old woman back to the house and get her to sit down, and she's sobbing and crying, and finally, she cries herself to sleep. And Mohan and his wife are talking and just really comforting each other and trying to comfort their son who's just lost his grandfather. They look around. The old woman's not there. They rush to the door. She's headed for the bridge. Mohan goes running after, screaming, "No, no." She walks to the middle of the bridge. Just before Mohan gets there, she looks at him, throws herself in the river and drowns. Well, at that point, his wife lost it. She wants to throw herself in the river. Mohan's got to drag her back to the house. And she's just hysterical and just completely, completely out of it. And he's trying to get her to calm down. And the little boy's upset. And he's really trying to get them calmed down. And finally his wife gets calmed down. And he gets her something to eat. And she's, you know, eating a chapati and just completely out of it. And the little boy starts crying again. And he turns to the little boy and says, "Do you want something to eat?" And "Yeah, oh, my grandparents." And he goes and gets another chapati and comes back. And where'd his wife go? Oh, no. He goes running out the door. His wife is standing in the middle of the bridge looking at the river. And he screams, "No!" And she looks at him, looks back at the river, throws herself in the river and drowns. Mohan sinks to his knees, face in his hands. This is horrible. This is the worst thing that could happen. When he looks up, his son is standing in the middle of the bridge. He screams, "No!" goes running to his son. His son looks at him, throws himself in the river, drowns. Mohan staggers to the middle of the bridge, looks down at the rushing water. Nothing to do. Puts his hands over his eyes, reaches out, topples over off the bridge. And just as his hand hits the water, the magician's wife says, "There you are, sir. Enjoy your tea." Things are not what they seem to be. And we get fooled so easily. You know, we'll pick up on any story and just run with it. There are illusions everywhere. I mean, there was, you know, the street magician's illusions. Did you know that if you took a stick or something like this and you squeezed your wrist really hard, you could make it float? You know, it wouldn't fall off. You're not impressed. I was impressed when my cousin showed me this when I was about 5. That trick is actually very ancient. They can trace it back to the Middle Ages. You know, there's all sorts of tricks, you know, card tricks, coin tricks, coins. You ever carry coins around with you? You know, little round things like with the picture of George Washington on it. Why do you carry them around? Is it because you want to know what George Washington looks like, right? I forgot what George Washington looks like. You know? Oh, yeah, right. Is that why you carry them around? No, it's because you need a screwdriver, right? No, maybe it's because you need to make a decision. No, you carry them around because they're valuable. But why are they valuable? Well, because we said they were valuable. They don't really have any intrinsic value. I mean, yeah, as a screwdriver. You carry around a picture of George Washington on a piece of metal. And you also carry around a picture of George Washington on a piece of paper, right? Now, why are you carrying around 2 pictures of George Washington? I mean, the piece of paper, it's got the same guy on it, but it's 4 times as valuable as the metal one. And the paper, I mean, you carry it around because you might need toilet paper? You carry it around because, oh, yeah, you can roll it up and... No, we don't do that anymore. You carry it around because we say it's valuable. Maybe you need to start a fire? No, it doesn't burn very well. And then you carry around the pictures of the grumpy Indian fighter, right? Andy Jackson. He's 20 times as valuable as the father of our country. Now, that makes really good sense. Right? I can understand Benjamin Franklin being, you know, 100 times as valuable as George Washington. Well, no, I can understand him being 5 times as valuable as the grumpy Indian fighter. But, I mean, we're carrying around these pieces of paper, and they're the same size, and they're the same color, and they just got dead guys on them. And you give them away so you can get stuff. Does this make any sense? It's an illusion, just like, you know, making stuff stick to your wrist. Right? It's just another kind of illusion. We just sort of agreed it was valuable. An even better illusion. Carry around little pieces of plastic, right? Got numbers on it, maybe a little cool hologram. Got your name on it. Turn it over. It's got your name that you wrote on it. You go into a store. You get a bunch of stuff. You walk out of the store. They get really upset. You go into the store. You get the same bunch of stuff. You go up to the front. You give them that piece of plastic. They give you back the piece of plastic. They give you 2 pieces of paper. You make magic marks on one piece of paper and give it back to them. The other piece of paper, you take it home and throw it away. You walk out, you got the same stuff. They're all happy. This is stupid. I'm sorry, this does not make any sense. Of course, this is not the end of it. Eventually, in the mail, comes a piece of paper, which you rip open, and inside that piece of paper is a bunch of pieces of paper more. And you shuffle through those pieces of paper, throwing away most of the pieces of paper inside that piece of paper, till you find the 2 pieces of paper that are valuable, right? One of those pieces of paper you rip the top off of. The rest of it, maybe you file that. And then you open your desk drawer and you pull out a stack of paper you got from your bank. And you make magic marks on that piece of paper. And you rip off the top piece of paper of that. And you stuff that in the top of the other piece of paper inside the other piece of paper. And you lick it and you seal it. And you stick a piece of paper in the corner and you throw it in a metal box. Is this any way to run the world? I mean, this is downright stupid when you think about it. And yet, it's an illusion. And we all agree to it and it all works. It's weird. There's illusions everywhere. You got a dot box at home? You all have dot boxes? I think they call them TVs, right? I mean, that's all it is a box of dots, right? And you plug in your TV and some of the dots get excited and light up and, you know, you're watching the soap opera. Well, hopefully you don't watch soap operas. You're watching the Duca Report, right? And this thing is vibrating in there and it makes sounds and you hear about the awful Duca that happened and you see pictures of the awful Duca and you get all upset. Just a box of dots, right? Ever watch guys watching sports on the dot box? They'd be screaming at those dots, go, go! Dots can't hear them, right? You ever go to the movies? What does it cost you to go to the movies these days? $10, $12, $15? I don't know what you pay. What are you doing? You pay in some of these dead presidents so you can watch a guy showing a bright light through a piece of plastic. Right? Oh, man, that was so good. That piece of plastic with the bright light shining through it. Well, you don't think of it like that. I mean, if it's good, you laugh. And you cry, and that ship sinks, and all those people die, and you're all upset, and you get tears streaming down your face. It's just a piece of plastic. And in fact, to make the piece of plastic, those people were acting. None of them drowned. You don't have to cry. But, you know, if you didn't cry, you didn't think you'd get your money's worth. It's an illusion. We're paying good money to be fooled here. All kind of illusions out there. There's the illusion of the solidity of the table and the floor, right? I mean, we know that it's just molecules that are mostly space. And the molecules are, you know, atoms where there is anything, but they're mostly space. And where there's something there, there's protons, neutrons, and electrons, but it's mostly space. And we look inside those protons, electrons, neutrons, and it's mostly space. You got gluons and quarks, and but, you know, stuff doesn't fall through it, so we're willing to go with it being solid. Illusions everywhere. Well, there's one illusion that's really hard to penetrate, and that's the illusion of self. Me, the most important person in the universe. Well, obviously, right? I mean, that's what it feels like. It feels like the world revolves around me. If I go stand in the middle of a field and I turn in a circle, the world revolves around me, right? Gotta be like that. It's an illusion that's hard to penetrate. But it's an illusion that we do need to penetrate. It's a harder illusion to penetrate than the time illusion. Remember I was talking last night about how time is something we make up? It's just an illusion. It's not what it appears to be. It's the same with the self. There's all these illusions around. There's the moon illusion. Moon comes up, full moon, gigantic, right? A couple hours later, it shrinks down. In San Francisco, you can do a really cool thing. You find a street that goes up to the east, and you stand at the bottom of the street, bottom of that hill, and you wait till the moon comes up, and it's gigantic. And then you run up to the top of the hill, and the moon shrinks down. And then you run back down to the bottom, and it gets big again. How does the moon know whether you're at the top of the hill or not? If you buy into illusion, you start doing silly things, right? You start asking silly questions like, how does the moon know where I'm at the top of the hill or not, right? This self-illusion causes us to do selfish things. The selfish things that we do are mostly about craving and clinging. And if we're doing craving and clinging, we're setting ourselves up for dukkha. If we don't want to experience dukkha, we have to stop craving and clinging, right? Third Noble Truth. And the strategy to stop the craving and clinging is to penetrate the illusion of self. It's a hard illusion to penetrate because it really feels like me. But this sense of self is like a rainbow. I mean, there's no such thing as a rainbow. A rainbow is, well, it's sunlight, and it's water droplets, and it's an observer in the right place. You got to have all three of these. If you got sunlight and rain droplets and nobody standing in the right place, ain't no rainbow. It is a participatory universe. You got to be in the right place. And furthermore, your friend that's standing next to you say, hey, look at the rainbow. And they go, yeah, cool rainbow. They're looking at a different rainbow than the one you're looking at. Right? Those raindrops that are refracting the light so you see it are different from the raindrops refracting the light so that your friend standing right next to you sees it. But you both agree there's a rainbow out there. But you know it's an illusion. You don't go looking for the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. And when you really examine it, you realize it's not a thing at all. It's a process. It's a dependently originated process. It depends on, well, the gravity in the sun mashing the sun together enough so that the hydrogen is getting fused into helium and releasing a lot of energy. It shows up as light waves that travel all that distance, 92 million miles, all the way to the Earth, bounce off some raindrops that happen to be falling down because of gravity, and then come back to your eyeball, which just happens to be in the same right place. This is where rainbows come from. It's not a thing. The sense of self is not a thing. It's arising as a process. We're taking this collection of processes and we're giving it a name called me. The idea is to penetrate that illusion. If you penetrate the illusion of self, then you have no basis for being selfish. There's another illusion, the illusion of the edge of the world. If you go down to the beach and you stand ankle deep in the ocean and you look out, you can see the edge of the world. It's 6 miles out, right? You know, a ship gets too close to the edge of the world and, you know, it sails, falls right over the edge, you know, disappears. Happens far too often. I mean, almost every time I go to the beach, I see some poor ship get too close to the edge of the world, fall off. All those people die. I don't know why they just don't understand not to go out there, right? My friend says to me, hey, you want to sail down to L.A.? And I'm like, no, man. We get too close to the edge of the world, we'll fall off. I'm making my decision based on an illusion, right? So let's say they come along, they grab me, they stuff me, well, not in the space shuttle anymore, into a Soyuz capsule, they blast me into orbit, I go up to the International Space Station, I look out, I see its curve, they explain the Earth is a sphere, they explain gravity to me, I come back, I go to the ocean, I stand there ankle deep, it looks just like it looked before. But now I no longer conceive of the edge of the world. When I see a ship sail over the horizon, I don't think it fell off the edge. My friend says to me, I got a sailboat, let's sail down to LA. I'm not going to say I'm not going to go because I'm afraid of falling off the edge of the world. Might not go because I'm afraid of getting seasick, all right? But I'm no longer making my decision based on an illusion. Penetrating that illusion provides wisdom. Penetrating the illusion of self provides the wisdom to stop acting selfishly. And by not acting selfishly, there's no craving and clinging, because you can't have craving and clinging without somebody craving to get it for me and clinging to it because it's mine. And with no craving and clinging, no dukkha. This is the Buddha's strategy to get out of dukkha. Now, when I tell you yourself is just an illusion, you might believe me, but probably not good enough so that you uproot any tendency for craving and clinging. When I told you last night that time was an illusion, if you've gone out and tried to walk outside of time, you might have found it somewhat difficult to stay there. Okay, you can step into it for a few moments, maybe 5 minutes or so, but then, you know, the thought of the past or the future, got to get back before the bell rings, right, comes creeping in and you make time happen again. I think penetrating the illusion of time is probably a lot easier than penetrating the illusion of self. Self-illusion is just a whole lot stickier because it's a very useful illusion. It enables us to, well, distinguish between the peanut butter and jelly sandwich and the fingers, right? But it's a necessary survival thing. It's just that it's not the deepest truth there is. It's something that gets in the way of giving up the craving and clinging. And so what we need to do is gain enough insight into reality that we're able to let go enough and have an experience without an experiencer. This experience without an experiencer, if it's profound enough, goes by the name of a path moment. There are four of these path moments, four of these progressively more profound experiences without an experiencer. This goes by the four stages of awakening. The first of these path moments is called stream entry. It is said that when one has this experience, one has entered the stream of the Dharma, which will carry them inevitably to full awakening. This experience without an experiencer uproots 3 of the 10 fetters that bind us to the wheel of samsara. The first and most important fetter that's uprooted is the what's called personality belief, or Yeah, I think that's probably the best way to put it. A sense of self that you believe is really there. You really believe there's a little guy sitting behind your eyeballs, pulling the levers, looking out. You really believe there's a soul in here that, yeah, somehow you can get it to survive death and, you know, have a better time next time. But the experience without an experiencer actually shows you there's not anybody in there. Right? You have experienced that there's nobody home. And so that uproots the belief in a self. It uproots personality belief. That experience also uproots the belief in the efficacy of rites and rituals. You no longer believe that you get enlightened by lighting enough candles. I mean, that kind of makes sense. Enlightenment, light candles, right? Right? No. Doesn't have anything to do with it. You find out that you had this not-self experience by doing the meditation practice and investigating reality till you finally got to the point where you were able to let go. And the third fetter that's uprooted is skeptical doubt. You did what the Buddha told you to do. You got the result he said you were going to get. What's to doubt? So that one is uprooted. And so this is the first level of awakening, stream entry. The second level of awakening, and stream enterers are said to have at most only 7 more lifetimes until they become fully awakened. The second level is a once returner. And this is someone, once they hit this spot, they'll only have 1 more lifetime before they're fully awakened. They'll only have to return to the human realm at most 1 more time. A once returner weakens 2 of the fetters. The fetters are usually called greed and hatred. Literally, it's passion for pleasure and ill will. So the passion for pleasure and ill will are weakened. Ayakema said cut in half, although the suttas just say weakened. Aya said that passion for pleasure becomes preference and ill will becomes irritation. Let's just say there's a significant weakening of your greed and hatred and leave it at that. But it's still there. And now, in order to get to the second level, one has to continue doing the practices that took you to the first level. You might repeat the first level along the way, not actually calling it a path moment because it didn't do anything to any of the fetters, but just repeating that not-self experience until you have a more profound not-self experience, which weakens the greed and hatred. And then you're a once-returner. To move on to the third stage, you keep doing the same practices. And you might repeat the once returner experience, but hopefully at some point you have an even more profound experience. And that uproots the passion for pleasure and the ill will. No more greed and hatred. This is a pretty profound place. And it's called non-returner. If someone who is a non-returner dies before full awakening, they won't return to the human realm. They'll finish up in one of the heavenly realms. Again, what's necessary? Keep practicing. Keep gaining more insight so that you let go even more profoundly. You might repeat the non-returner experience of nobody home again and again until you have an even more profound experience. And that's full awakening, arhatship. And that uproots the last of the 5, the last 5 of the 10 fetters. Passion for form, passion for formless, which is usually interpreted to mean desire for rebirth in worlds of form or desire for rebirth in formless worlds, although the words are just passion for form and passion for formless. 3 is ignorance, conceit, and restlessness. So the ignorance is ignoring the fact that there's not anybody home. The conceit is conceiving of a self. And so now with no more self-conceiving, no more selfish behavior, no more craving and clinging, no more dukkha. And restlessness. The restlessness is finally uprooted because nobody there to be restless. These are the stages of awakening, and there are a gradual deepening of this experience of nobody home, this experience of not self, this experience without an experiencer. The good news is it doesn't really matter where you are on the path. You still got to do the same practices. You still got to investigate reality. You still got to get a deep understanding of anicca, dukkha, and anatta. So hitting one of these states doesn't change what you do next. You just keep on practicing. And hopefully you have an even more profound experience that takes you on to deeper states. The last thing I'm going to say is, okay, so I made some noise about, you know, maybe there's not actual rebirth or something. So what is this seven times you're reborn, once returner, non-returner stuff? Well, it turns out that the concept of a once-returner and a non-returner existed in the Upanishads before the time of the Buddha. If you were practicing the Upanishads and you got really good, then maybe at your death you could have union with the sun, right? But you couldn't stay there. And when you died from that incarnation, you'd be born back here again one more time. And then you get to go all the way. Or if you were even better, instead of union with the sun, you might get, you know, union with the sun at a deeper level, so you wouldn't have to come back. And when you passed away from there, you get direct union with Brahma. Or if you were really, really good here, you could just go directly to union with Brahma without having to do the union with the sun. So this idea of once returner or non-returner were actually concepts from the Upanishad, and the Buddha, as he often did, took a concept, tweaked it, and used it as part of his teaching. Did he mean it literally? Well, you can argue any way you want for that. And then the seven times stuff seems to have been inserted a bit later. Or maybe the Buddha really said that. So, this sense of self that you have is an illusion. And progress on the spiritual path, really deep progress, comes from penetrating that illusion. Any questions or comments?
How someone knows if you are on the third coming or
the
fourth coming or seven?
Yeah. So you're a stream enterer.
If you're a stream enterer,
now is this your third time back or your seventh time back? Don't know. But it doesn't matter because the practice remains the same. So, yeah.
Isn't it the number of long retreats you need to do?
It could be the number of long retreats you need to do. That certainly is going to be helpful. But yeah, there's no hints given. It's actually discussed in quite a number of different ways, and there are, what, five different kinds of non-returner? And I mean, yeah, it gets into this very elaborate mythology here. I'd say don't worry about that. I'd say just do the practice. Gain enough insight into the three characteristics so that you can let go and have that experience without an experiencer. And don't worry about, is this your first time back, fifth time back, never been back, any of this stuff.
So if in the first round, one of the fetters that goes is, say, belief in rites and rituals, and last night you said, so really think about rites and rituals as habits or, you know, kind of concretized ways of being or whatever. So is there any use in the more mundane release of habits, fetters? I mean,
yeah.
Could you talk about that?
Because what gets uprooted is the belief in the efficacy of rites and rituals for awakening. Okay, so the belief that something other than insight into the nature of reality is going to get you awakened. Right? So, belief that lighting enough candles will get me enlightened, or doing enough prostrations. So those are rites and rituals. But it could be any other habit that you have that you believe is going to make you ultimately happy, right? And you see that, getting up in the morning and having a cup of coffee is not going to lead to enlightenment. It's just a habit. You might still do the habit, right? But you don't believe it's going to take you all the way. Some of our habits are actually pretty good. If you're in the habit of turning out the light when you leave the room, good on you, right? And I'd say keep doing that. But you don't believe turning out the light when you leave the room is going to get you enlightened, right? So, yeah, that one you didn't have to worry about. So it's more the efficacy of rites and rituals that's uprooted rather than the belief in rites and rituals. And you can still do rites and rituals. They can be helpful. Helpful for reminding you, oh yeah, right. If I bow, that's humility, and I could probably use a little bit more of that, or whatever.
In the department of be careful what you wish for, you hear a lot about experience with no self being uncomfortable. What advice is there?
Well, the first piece of advice would be, yeah, good thing to encounter. In the suttas, in the commentaries, in the Visuddhimagga, there's a simile that's given. It says that you're on the near bank of the river, and it's fearful and dangerous, and there's safety on the far bank. And on the near bank, there's a giant tree growing up with a branch over the river, and there's a rope hanging down from that branch. And what you need to do is run with the momentum of practice and grab hold of the rope and swing across to the far side. Now, to get to the far bank, what you got to do? Let go, right? And when you let go, you land on the other side. But when you land, you've had a fall and you've dropped and you're unstable, right? But you got to collect yourself, pick yourself up, and get on to the further part of the far shore. So this is actually pointing out a whole bunch of what it takes. It takes enough momentum of the practice, right? If you just stand there and you grab hold of the rope and just hang on, and I'm going to make it to the far shore, right? And it also points out you've got to really let go. If you run with enough momentum and grab hold and swing over to the far side and decide, oh, I'll just let go with one hand, that doesn't work. You've got to completely let go. And then the thing about falling on the other side and feeling unstable. Yeah, this often happens. Hopefully there's a teacher around that you can talk to that has some clue as to what's going on, has been tracking your practice and tracking what's going on with you in your practice so that they're not totally shocked when you show up and start describing this experience without an experiencer. And they can help you start to integrate the experience. But yes, there does have to be this period of integration. And if you don't have a context for this, it can scare the bejesus out of you. All right? So hopefully you've got the context in which you've been practicing. And when something like this happens, although it might be rather unsettling, there's someone around you can talk to, and then you've got time to integrate the experience. Because there's no way you're going to be able to go to the next step or even repeat the experience until you've managed to integrate it. Sometimes there's debate about sudden enlightenment or gradual enlightenment. And I think what we find is there's gradual practice and then sudden awakening, a sudden experience that takes you to the next level, that's a breakthrough in consciousness, and then gradual integration of that experience before you can move on to the next level. Does that answer your question?
So the practice of sila, I understand, is a way for me to develop a healthy, balanced, unremorseful sense of self.
Mm-hmm.
So I can interact on a relative plane.
Right.
And then let go of it.
Mm-hmm. Transcend it.
Transcend it.
Yeah. See that it's just a useful illusion.
It's not established. If it's not established, if I'm still processing, I'm still going through deep therapy, you know, and I'm tangled up, and I run out and try to do rigor or something, I can spin myself right out.
Well, you might be able to do RIGPA, but you're not going to have a stream entry experience until you're willing to let go, right? And that letting go may require that you do some work on the stuff that you're hanging on to.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So the psychological insights you have along the way are actually quite important. They can't take you all the way. But if you don't have those psychological insights, then you're not going to be able to resolve what's unresolved in there and have the more profound insights into anicca, dukkha, anatta that enables you to completely let go. So the work that you're doing on yourself is actually very good work, even though the self you're working on is an illusion. It's really necessary to get a good, solid illusion before you can penetrate it. Otherwise, you can't see how you're confused or anything, right? So, yeah, you've got to get a good, solid illusion before you can see through it.
So there's something I maybe not fully understood in your explanation. When you said you revisit,
mm-hmm.
So that means that the four stages are four times through the same.
No.
Insight, or
you have a deep enough insight so that you experience without an experiencer for the first time, and it uproots the fetters. You keep practicing. You have enough new insights, and you let go again. But the experience that ensues from that letting go is the same experience as you had before. It's not more profound. Okay, so you're still doing the practice and so forth. And you might go through a similar experience as you build up to that letting go, as you experienced before, and you might do it multiple times. Or you might build up to that letting go with a completely different set of circumstances, and then let go and have a similar experience. In other words, the first time, perhaps you're doing the arising and passing practice, and you start seeing the anicca nature of everything, and you actually let go, and you have the stream entry experience. And then at some other time, you might actually be working with arising and passing and basically have the same experience again. And at some other time, you might be working with not self and have the same experience, but you come at it from a completely different direction. Does that answer your question?
Well, by the same experience, I mean, it's not the same.
Well, it's an experience without an experiencer in all three cases, but at the same level of profoundness. Okay? It's not more profound to take you to the next level.
The insight is something that happens, but it's enough in itself to make you have a decision moment to let go of something, or it's something that just like moves you in that direction and you actually feel that you are on that path to, you know,
yeah,
let go of whatever.
Right. It actually takes a lot of insights.
Right.
And the insights often progress through a stage referred to as the dark night. Okay, you start seeing the world and you realize it's very different from how you thought it was. It's enough different that it actually is worrisome or freaky or terrifying or any degree of that. All right? You have to work your way through that terror. You have to come to terms with the fact that you have now seen the world in a different light. The world, you're working with the rising and passing, and you realize that there's nothing you can hang on to. There's no security. Everything is arising and passing all the time. There's nothing that can be clung to. And it freaks you out. And then you've got to integrate this new insight into your psyche. That process of integration happens by just continuing to practice until finally you reach a stage of equanimity about what you've come to see, this new view of reality, this new disturbing insight into how things really are. So now you're at a stage of what is usually called equanimity about fabrications, or equanimity about concoctions. Equanimity about formations is the usual translation. From that state, because your mind is so equanimous, and because you have a new view of reality, then you can attempt to let go. Right? You can get in touch with the fact that you would rather have the deepest truth there is than hang on to anything. And if you really indeed do want the deepest truth there is, then maybe you can let go. Particularly coming out of one of the higher jhanas, it may be possible to just sort of send your mind out and see what happens. And if it starts going on its own, just let it go and see what happens. And it might take you to a path moment. Or it might not do anything. Or you're working on this and nothing is happening, and then you're sitting there making yourself a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and you let go. Right? So the letting go could happen in any circumstances. But there has to be a deeper understanding of reality than we usually have, and an integrating of that deeper understanding into our psyche, and this willingness to let go. And so the letting go might happen in formal practice, or it might happen, you know, you're just sitting there trying to get to access concentration and let go. Or it might just happen when you're walking to the dining hall.
What I was trying to say is, this integration is not something that's like, oh, now I have to integrate that to my... Or that comes slowly and you absorb it in your psychic, on your the way you relate to the world and life, and slowly, and you know that something is becoming different, it is different.
Right.
And you actually can tell the difference, but... is it a conscious integration, or is something that it's naturally absorbed on your daily life if you continue practicing?
If you continue practicing, continue looking at reality in terms of anicca, dukkha, anatta, then the integration is going to happen without you doing really much about saying, oh, I've got to integrate this. Okay? You just continue the investigation, and the integration will take place on its own. And in fact, I don't think it's possible to say, okay, I'm going to integrate this, and so I'm going to do whatever. Okay, it's more just keep practicing, which is makes it really convenient for me as a teacher. You know, I just say, yeah, just keep practicing, you know, whatever goes on. And it's good for you as a student because, yeah, you just keep practicing. Yeah.
This whole process is kind of in a realm that's outside of, not within logic or rational.
This whole process is not something that can, how did the Buddha put it, be obtained by mere reasoning. Yeah. It's something that you have to experience. You have to gain enough insight, and insights, remember, are understood experiences, that you're willing to let go. And then the letting go can cause you to have such an experience. But, yeah, you can't go, yep, makes sense to me, nobody home. Yep, okay, I've given it up. It just doesn't work like that. Right? You really got to have the experience. The way Ayakema said it was, if you've never had a mango, and somebody tells you about a mango, right? It's a fruit. It's got a skin that you've got to peel off. It's orange on the outside. You peel it, it's orange on the inside. It's really juicy. It's really sweet. There's a big seed in the middle. Do you have any clue what a mango tastes like? No, you think it's a peach. The only way to know what a mango tastes like is bite into the mango. The only way to know what not self tastes like is to have the experience without an experiencer. Okay, no further questions. We'll take a short break and then do metta.